Hi, everyone. This is Maya welcoming you to today's second live podcast organized by the Berkeley Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies. Join us for virtual gatherings to keep up to date with topics related to Israel and Jewish law, thought, and identity. Today's episode is titled A Coronavirus Lesson, How Jews and Arabs United to Fight a Plague in Palestine a Century Ago. On Tuesday, we zoomed in to Israel's political context and examine the impacts of coronavirus on the elections process. And today, instead of looking forward and predicting the future, we're going to actually look back at the past and to lessons that we can learn from another global crisis a century ago. So 100 years before coronavirus, tens of thousands of Arabs and Jews died in Palestine's worst 20th century plague. And they recognized the catastrophe as their shared enemy and cooperated to take measures to defend against it. So today we're lucky to have Zach Foster here with us, whose expertise lies on the history of Palestine in early 20th century, at the time at which this plague took place. And Zach completed his PhD in Near Eastern Studies at Princeton, and he's the host of Middle East Tonight, a YouTube show that's focused on political satire. From 9 to 5, Zach is also a PM at academia. So Zach, thanks for joining us today. So it seems like you've been really busy for the first week of your quarantine. You've published an article on Tehet Haaretz that we're talking about today. And you've also created a video for Middle East Tonight about coronavirus and included reactions from around the world. So I just wanted to start off and hear how the past few days have been, how you're adjusting, and just a bit about those projects.
First of all, Maya, thank you so much for inviting me to join this podcast. It is exciting to be able to share my work, my research. So I'm very happy to be here. So how have things changed for the past few days? Obviously, daily life has changed dramatically for all of us. I'm working from home. I'm cooking. I'm counting how many sheets of toilet paper I use per bathroom trip. So things are changing almost just day by day. We're learning and discovering new things about the coronavirus. Obviously glued to the news, worried about family, glued to Reddit, refreshing world meters, like rage clicking. So I think just taking it day by day.
Thank you. So yeah, I want to start off with just getting a little bit of background around this plague. Can you tell us a little bit more about what it looked like on the ground, both right before the plague hit? Like, what was the historical context?
Yeah, totally. So the locust plague that we're going to talk about today happened in 1915. It started in March 1915 and lasted almost a full calendar year. So the context here is Ottoman Palestine, 1915. So what's going on in the Ottoman Empire in 1915? What's going on in the world in 1915? Obviously, World War I here is the context that we need to all have in mind. So remember, World War I breaks out in Europe in July 1914. And already in Palestine, the effects are felt immediately because you have already tens of thousands of foreigners visiting Palestine as pilgrims and as tourists. So essentially, tourism stops. You have lots of foreign banks in Palestine in the late Ottoman period. So there's a French bank, there's a British bank, there's an American bank, there's a German bank. The foreign banks close. And foreigners essentially leave and pack up and take their capital with them. And you have a rush on the banks already in August. Basically, the Ottoman government is forced to implement a moratorium on banks because people are rushing to the banks to withdraw their life savings. So already in the early months of the war, long before the Ottomans have even joined the war effort, Palestine is already in a state of crisis. So that's the context here. The Ottoman Empire joins the World War I on the side of the Germans in October. Not really relevant why they joined the side of the Germans. Obviously, that was a catastrophic mistake, but they did. The Ottoman Empire joins the war. December 1914, January 1914, things were already starting to look pretty bleak. So that is sort of the setting, and more or less, so as this country is descending into chaos, Remember that also trade has come to a halt. There's no, many of Palestine's major export industries, like the citrus crops, the orange groves of Jaffa and the coast, that had been blossoming in the decades prior to World War I. All of that income is wiped out overnight. You can't ship crates of oranges to Europe in during wartime because there's a blockade of the Eastern Mediterranean. The British and French institute a blockade starting in December 1914, so you can't ship goods abroad. And that affects not just the citrus industry, but of course also shipments of barley, wheat. There's a lot of actually export of other primary goods like cotton. So basically the economy has already come to a standstill right on the eve of this locust plague.
So then essentially we're looking at a crisis upon a crisis is what I'm hearing from you. So yeah. I'm curious in this situation then, so we have kind of leading up to it, what was going on. And then I'm both curious, maybe first you can just illustrate to us a bit of a picture of like what this looks like. So locusts sound scary. They sound biblical. It's strange. But like, besides being terrifying, like what exactly did it look like to have this plague come down? And then where did it come from?
Yeah, so for those of you who are familiar with the Passover Seder, I don't want to make any assumptions here, but locusts are one of the 10 plagues. It's like number 8. And just a fun anecdote for your Passover Seder, to understand how locust attacks occur and why they occur. So locusts live lives of solitude in the desert. And then whenever there's big rainstorms, basically all of these eggs that locusts hatch, so locusts, they lay, 50, 100 eggs in the dry desert sand. And usually all of those eggs die because these eggs need moisture in the soil in order to hatch. That's when the eggs hatch. So whenever you get big desert rainstorms, you get locust outbreaks. And then, so actually, if you go back and recount the plagues, what's the plague right before locusts? It is, I think hail, locust attacks. Why do they happen? You get these huge desert rainstorms that happen about once every 10 to 15 years. And the result of these desert rainstorms is that all these locust eggs that would have otherwise died in the dry desert sand end up hatching. And so you get these big locust swarms. Usually the way the migratory patterns of the locusts in the Middle East is that they start in the Horn of Africa, Sudan, Egypt, Ethiopia. They make their way across the Arabian, across the Red Sea. They can fly. The locusts go through multiple stages of life. They first start off crawling. And then basically when they rub against other locusts, I don't understand the biology behind locusts very well, but basically it's very unique to this species, but they rub each other and then they can grow wings and they end up flying. So you have these huge swarms that start in the Horn of Africa. They're flying across the Red Sea. They go to the Arabian Peninsula. They obviously can go to Palestine, Israel. They go all the way as far as the Indian subcontinent and can go all the way far as north as Turkey and even Greece. So in fact, there's actually a massive locust attack happening right now as we speak. It looks like it's going to miss Israel, Palestine, but it's hitting the Horn of Africa pretty hard right now. And it's also hitting the Arabian Peninsula and going to, there are big locust attacks in Pakistan as well right now. So interesting moment in history where we're seeing essentially a plague on top of the coronavirus, which I would expect to have a catastrophic impact on crop yields in the coming months. But anyways, back to 1915. So locusts, they come in big swarms and they eat everything. A locust can eat the equivalent of its own body weight in a single day. So basically what happens in 1915 is that they come in around March, remember? And if you know the harvest seasons, the big grain, the winter harvest, the harvest of the grains and the barley, this happens in March, April, 1915. So actually in 1915, most of the wheat crop had already been harvested. before the attacks. Only maybe my estimate is 10 to 15% of the wheat harvest was eaten. But the real damage came in the summer and fall. In the summer, you get all the fruits and vegetables, which in terms of the caloric intake of the populations of Israel and Palestine in 1915 was, I mean, we're talking potatoes, onions, eggplant, you know, and then of course the olive harvest, which doesn't come until 1915, but olive oil is really the primary source of, but one of the key sources of caloric intake, especially among the peasants, that was completely wiped out. So you have a massive hit on more or less all major crops, again, save for the wheat and barley in the winter. But the locusts devour everything. And remember, that happened, of course, after the country's already in a state of crisis. So the impact was devastating.
Yeah, that sounds devastating and really tough and hard to imagine. So I'm curious, beyond the damage to resources, to crops, are there any other impacts that that happened during that time?
Yeah, so as a result of the loss in crops, we start to see starvation settling in already in the spring and summer of 1915. And by the end of the war, estimates vary, but between 350,000 and 500,000 people in greater Syria, so not just Israel-Palestine, but say, you know, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Israel-Palestine. So the estimates are that roughly between 350,000 and 500,000 people died from either starvation or starvation-related deaths, like disease. So, of course, if you're malnourished, you're much more susceptible to all kinds of diseases. Typhus, fever, smallpox, measles, cholera. There was a big cholera outbreak during the war. In Israel-Palestine, we don't have exact numbers. And of course, remember, there was no district of Palestine during World War I. That was not an administrative unit in the Ottoman Empire. And so, you know, trying to even decide what constitutes Israel-Palestine, how many deaths there were in Israel-Palestine at the time is a bit tricky. But we can definitely say in the tens of thousands of people died from either starvation or a starvation-related death, like disease.
Okay, so I'm curious, given this crisis, given all the impact that it created on lives lost, on resources, economically. So firstly, I'm curious, what were the efforts to combat this plague? What was being done? And then maybe also as a follow-up, how did Jews and Arabs come together to coordinate their efforts around this crisis?
Yeah, so the remedy for locust attacks among the ultra-Orthodox population of Jerusalem was well known. It was praying and fasting. I think agronomists took a different approach. The person put in charge of fighting the locust attack was this guy named Aharon Aronson. He was actually a Jewish Zionist, agronomist. He was put in charge of defeating the locusts by the governor of Greater Syria at the time, Jamal Pasha. And the what were the major strategies of fending off the locusts? Well, first of all, there were state mandated instructions that every person go and collect locust eggs from the soil. So basically, just kind of actually quite similar to a virus, you get multiple waves of locust attacks. So basically what you get is the first wave, then the locusts that come in the first wave, they lay eggs. So all these locusts that came from the Arabian Peninsula and the Horn of Africa in like March and April, they laid eggs in the spring. And so and those eggs then hatched and created a second wave in the summer. And the second wave laid eggs, which led to a third wave in the fall. So collecting eggs was a big one. In fact, I think the requirement for each Ottoman citizen was 3 kilos of eggs. There were also attempts to actually put tin sheets into the sand, basically in the Negev. There are these incredible photos of just like miles and miles of like tin sheets into the sand, because basically if locusts are still in their crawling phase of life, they have a very difficult time crawling up tin. There were also attempts to even today, you'll see if you just Google news, like watch the videos right now from the Horn of Africa, the locusts really hate these like banging noises. So if you just like make loud banging noises around them, they all like fly away. There were other things that were done, but for the most part, the efforts were rather futile. There was just no possible way to contain. Once the outbreaks get so big and so large, we're talking billions and billions and billions of locusts. It's just almost impossible to get it under control once the outbreak has grown to these kinds of proportions that it did in 1915. And then on the question of like Jewish-Arab kind of efforts, so actually the historical record is pretty sparse here. There are some anecdotes of joint groups going out to the fields of Jews and Arabs. We have a few anecdotes like that. We do know that there were this Pasteur Institute for Health that was established before the war treated everybody, Jews, Muslims, and Christians alike. We also know that there was an American a ship of supplies that was sent to Palestine from American Zionists that was intended for the Zionist community in Palestine. To provide relief. So it had medicines, it had food. And when it landed in Haifa in early 1916, the Ottoman governor actually, even though the goods were all earmarked for the Zionist community, actually divided it between Jews, Muslims, and Christians out of fear of kind of sort of violence and you know, in response to basically all the supplies and food going to just one community. So, you know, there were attempts to try to deal with this disaster, this plague as a community, rather than sort of as individuals.
And so you kind of alluded that some of these efforts were futile. It's also interesting because when I imagine, you know, collecting the eggs, that feels like potentially it's more of a charitable, like helping the entire community deal with this kind of solution, while banging, you know, having them fly away from your farm seems to potentially just inflict damage on those around, or at least not help the situation. But I'm curious, were these efforts at all effective? Was the kind of, you know, the collaboration, but also just like the community coming together to act against this, do you think that made a big impact, or maybe just psychologically on like feeling like they're doing something about the crisis?
It's tough to tell what impact the measures had. What we do know is that the locust outbreaks continued well into the summer and the fall, and had the effect, had the collection efforts been successful, you might have expected the outbreaks to have died down, when in fact they actually got worse. So, unclear how effective they were. What I will say, though, is that the communal efforts of especially there were efforts on the part of the American colony in Jerusalem to offer relief. They opened up a soup kitchen. Those were critical. When it comes to mitigating the effects of starvation and disease, the communal efforts proved essential. And when it comes to mitigating the effects of the locusts themselves, I think they proved relatively futile.
And then before I jump for a moment to present times, could you tell us just a bit more about what happened after? So once this finally did die down, once the moment passed, what were the kind of ramifications of this whole crisis, and how did the community recover, or how long did that take?
Well, the Zionist community in Palestine was devastated by World War I. I think the demographic figures I've seen suggest that the community roughly decreased by one third. So I think from about 60,000 to maybe 40,000, maybe it was from 50,000 to 30,000. I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think it decreased by about a third. So in terms of impact on the local populations, it was devastating, including the Zionist community, including the Palestinian community. I mean, of course, World War I, I mean, is remembered for lots of things. I mean, in sort of Zionist mythology, it is partially remembered as well as like a turning point, of course, because you had the Balfour Declaration takes place during World War I. You have the Ottoman Empire collapses after World War One, and then, you know, as a result of the war, the British invade Palestine from Egypt and occupy Palestine and Syria, and the French occupy Lebanon and Syria. So the war is a transformative moment in the history of the modern Middle East, both for Palestinian nationalism and as well as Zionism. So, I would say that the impact of the locust plague in particular was perhaps limited to the months and years immediately after the plague, but the impact of the war itself and the momentous political changes that took place as a result of the war had long-lasting impacts.
All right. Thank you so much, Zach. I want to bring it back and connect to the coronavirus crisis just for one last question. So this region is likely to be affected a bit differently than other contexts. Of course, each place is affected differently, and that's not unique to this region, but I'm just curious, as so many divisions remain between like in Israel-Palestine, we can likely anticipate that there'll be some more challenges for people living, for example, in the West Bank and Gaza. On Wednesday, I know that it was announced that there were 44 confirmed cases in Bethlehem, and the number is probably going to rise if it is indicative of what's going on in other areas. So could you share a bit more about how you anticipate the situation to unfold today? Do you anticipate any similar anecdotes of collaborations, or have you seen any so far? Between either the Palestinian Authority and Israel in different areas?
Yeah, so I saw the same headline you saw, that there is collaboration between the health ministries of both the Palestinian Authority and Israel. Who knows how that will play out? I think that story just broke today, was it? Or maybe yesterday? What I will say is that for the purposes of understanding the spread of the virus, Israel and the West Bank are one country. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who live in the West Bank legally work inside Israel every day. Many, many thousands more cross into Israel to work every day illegally. Settlers are obviously moving to and from these places. So for the purposes of understanding and controlling the spread of the virus, you really have to treat the West Bank and Israel as one place. Now, for the purpose, whether or not we will see the kind of collaboration that I think is going to be necessary to get the coronavirus under control in Israel and Palestine remains to be seen. Having said that, there's quite a long history of collaboration between the Palestinian Authority and Israel, right? I mean, the Palestinian Authority, up until really the past, let's say, year or two, when things have deteriorated as a result of the Trump's deal of the century approach, which has totally alienated the Palestinians and won over the Israelis. Until the Trump administration came to office, I would say that there actually was pretty good security coordination between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority is almost a kind of a subcontractor of the Israeli control in the West Bank. What I would say as well, though, the last point I would make is that it certainly is a bit worrying, because you have to remember, in a world where there's a shortage of supplies, especially things like ventilators, not to mention other things, just like necessary medicines and hospital beds and face masks and hand sanitizers and soap, et cetera. In a world where the West Bank is completely controlled by Israel, what is that collaboration going to look like when there's a shortage of supplies? That's certainly something I worried about. You can't ship supplies into the West Bank without going through Israel. And if Israel's faced with tough decisions about who gets ventilators, I mean, would you trust that the Bibi Netanyahu government is going to divide those equitably? Certainly something I would be worried about if I was living in the West Bank right now.
All right, so maybe with that, we'll thank you, Zach, and we'll let you go. And we really appreciate you taking the time to join us for today's episode.
Sure thing, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much to everyone for joining.